in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, May 13th, 2014. We're talking today about the catastrophists. We're talking about the predictions of doom and gloom, that this or that problem is going to sink human civilization once and for all. And yet we always seem to rise to the occasion. We seem to be resilient enough to deal with these problems. Well, we're talking today to Robert Bryce, author of the new book out just today, Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper: How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists Wrong. What a fun book this is to read. As I say, today is the release date. Head on over and check it out. Robert Bryce is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He's the author of numerous books. He's been an author and journalist for nearly three decades. You can check him out at robertbryce.com. Robert, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me, Tom.
Quite a provocative book you have here. I'd like you to start off just with the two-minute précis of what it is you're trying to accomplish in this book.
Well, I can probably do it in less than 2 minutes. The book is a rebuke to the catastrophists, a rebuttal to this continuing refrain that we're doomed, a refrain that we've heard since Thomas Malthus. This is an optimistic book. The subtitle says it. How innovation keeps proving the catastrophists wrong. How are we proving the catastrophists wrong? By continually innovating, by making things smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper.
Now, I'm inclined to agree with you, but what do you say to the naysayer who says that Bryce's confidence in human ingenuity is akin to a guy who jumps off a cliff and then in midair assures us we have nothing to worry about because somebody's going to invent a parachute for him?
Well, I appreciate the analogy, but look, we've jumped off the cliff a long time ago. We were born naked and alone, and we've been struggling through ever since. I mean, you know, this is what we humans do. We're not going to just sit around and freeze in the dark. That's not what we've done. It's not what we will do. The reality is that today, despite all the problems, and we have a lot of them, and we could spend the rest of this time just listing them, you know, peak oil, the fear of pandemics, epidemics, lack of fresh water, you know, possible decline in agricultural productivity. But the reality is, the hard facts show that people today are living longer, healthier, freer lives than at any time in human history. And why is that? Because we continue innovating. We continue making things, our phones and our communications, smaller and faster and cheaper. We continue making our engines denser and more efficient. We continue having denser agricultural productivity. All these things are of a piece with our ability to continue feeding and managing the people that we have on the planet and those that are to come.
What's enjoyable about this book is that it's, in a way, it's in bite-sized pieces, at least part two anyway, where you're giving example after example after example of the trend you've just described, and you can read them in bite-sized chunks, and you can follow the trend by which things become smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper. Can you take one example that you find especially apt and trace us through the process of kind of dumb and big and awkward to what we have now? In fact, before I let you do that, I don't know if you saw this. This went around the internet some time ago, but somebody was sending around an old Radio Shack circular from 1991, and you could see all the things that were on sale at Radio Shack in 1991. And then the person pointed to every single item on that circular and said, the iPhone does everything that all these devices do. If you need an alarm clock, it does that. You need a stopwatch, it does that. You need an audio recorder, it does that. So the whole Radio Shack circular could be rolled up into a ball and thrown away and replaced by one tiny item.
I saw that, and I thought it was remarkable as well. And I can continue that same idea by thinking about the iPhone, or the smartphone I carry in my pocket has 250,000 times more digital storage capacity than the computer that went to the moon on board Apollo 11. But, you know, so that's smaller, faster. The smartphones we carry today are the embodiment of this trend: smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper. Have they made our lives substantially better? I would argue that they have, in fact. They've made things a lot more efficient in terms of the whole marketplace. Think about how quickly you can get information on weather or on airplanes, on airplane flights, or on travel or on traffic. You can get, you know, the mapping so you don't get lost, don't waste time. Look at residential electricity here in the United States. This is one that I find truly remarkable. I was born in 1960. I'm 53 years old. Since I was born, the price of residential electricity in real dollars has fallen 40%. You know, this is of a piece, though, with practically everything in our economy. Things aren't getting more expensive. Actually, they're getting cheaper. And that's true across a whole range of industrial commodities. So why is this happening? Because, again, of this human ingenuity. And so I wrote the book as a way to, you know, as a brushback pitch, as a reality check. We're continually hit with these dystopian views of today and tomorrow in our literature, and, you know, from Gulliver's Travels to Blade Runner to the new Lego movie, all of them are about doomed civilization. And in fact, we're living in that supposedly doomed civilization, and things that people have never been freer or healthier.
I think the key objection that you're likely to get from people who would otherwise accept what you're saying, that there have been tremendous advances in technology, tremendous advances in many, many areas of life, but they'll say it all runs on energy, right? That if that falls apart, then everything else you're talking about falls by the wayside. So that really is the key, isn't it, to understanding what's going on in energy. So what is going on in energy?
And there again, the trend has been towards smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper throughout. Look at nuclear reactors. Now, of course, from the left, you'll hear, oh, nuclear's so dangerous, can't possibly manage it. Well, in fact, the United States produces more nuclear energy, in fact, about twice as much as France does. We're leading the world in the nuclear energy business. And in the wake of Fukushima, have there been problems? Yeah, Fukushima, absolutely. But even today, the investments in new nuclear technology are accelerating with venture capital and all kinds of new technologies coming to the fore. But forget that. Let's look at Ford Motors. Look at the engine that was in the Model T. 2.9-liter engine produced 22 horsepower. Today, you can buy the base model Ford engine with the EcoBoost configuration. 1 liter. 1 liter produces over 120 horsepower and is three times as efficient as the one we got in the Model T. All around us, you know, in energy consumption, people are getting electricity and coming out of the dark and into the light. All around the world, people are becoming more mobile because we're making better engines and using better fuels.
Can you explain, before critiquing it, what the thesis of peak oil is?
Sure. Well, it's really simple. Peak oil is the belief that we're running out, civilization on this planet is going to continue demanding more oil continually. And, the energy industry won't be able to provide enough oil to meet demand. Well, we've heard this, in fact, and we've heard these threats about peak oil now for really about 100 years. But the peak oil crowd really had their heyday in the last decade or so. And what happened? The shale gale happened, the shale revolution, so much so that the U.S. today is producing about 15% more oil than it did a year ago today. The U.S. is producing 40% more natural gas today than it did in 2005. So these claims, these predictions about gloom and doom, that we're all headed for hell in a handbasket, hasn't proven true.
I like the name of one of your subheadings in part two of one of your chapter titles, From Monks to MOOCs, Faster, Cheaper Education. First of all, what does MOOC stand for?
massively open online courses. So you have the universities, Stanford, you know, some of the other elite universities and some that are not elite, offering some of their courses online to whoever wants to sign up for free. Now, this is a remarkable turn of events. Khan Academy is really one that I'm the most familiar with. My son uses it, which Khan Academy was created by Salman Khan. His parents were immigrants to the United States of Bangladeshi origin. He's an incredibly smart fellow. And he created an online curriculum now that has expanded enormously. He has a whole team of people working with him now. He's getting a lot of money from foundations, the Gates Foundations and others, Gates Foundation and others. And he has all kinds of coursework there. But he began in mathematics, which is what my son uses. He's an eighth grader. He's 14. And it's a remarkably sophisticated program. And it's free. So we've gone from monks to moots. We've gone from 1,000 years ago, even, you know, 400 or 500 years ago, where books were extraordinarily rare, where the ability to educate yourself or to educate others was extremely rare, and it was really the province of only the clergy and the elite and the very wealthy. And today, anyone with a computer and an internet connection can access courses that are online and incredibly sophisticated and free.
What I find extraordinary about this is that although we do have a great many people who have benefited tremendously from these sorts of advances, I among them, and there are so many people taking these courses, there are so many people who are learning a new skill because the information is being conveyed to them on the internet, and yet there still seems to be a chunk of the human race that even when you say to them, here's all the knowledge in the world, you can have it for free with the click of a mouse, you can learn anything you want to, they still won't read a book. You know, like, what do you do with people like this? I know that's not your responsibility to answer.
And you could communicate, and not only that, you have all this through Project Gutenberg, incredible number of books that you can read online for free, newspapers you can read online for free. You can also then communicate with nearly anyone else on the planet for free or nearly free. We've never been as networked or as connected today as we are with communications devices that are as small, as fast, as cheap, as light as the ones we're using now. It's an incredible time to be alive on this planet.
You know, the Marxists used to say that capitalism was less efficient than socialism. Socialism would create greater abundance. And then when that exactly, that became laughable. They had to say, well, the problem is capitalism creates so much abundance that it makes everybody fat and consumerist, and so then that became bad. Well, likewise, the internet is very hard to dispute the benefits of it and all the creative and wonderful ways people have used it. So now you'll hear the naysayers saying, well, that's all well and good, but now people are using this to substitute for real flesh and blood relationships. And I think that's a real stretch because I can't have a real flesh and blood relationship with somebody in Tanzania, in Lebanon, in South Korea, in France all at once. But using my little online platform, I can have an online seminar and talk to all these people in a classroom setting all at once. I think that enhances human relationships.
Well, of course, and it enhances that ability of cross-pollination, that ability to share ideas. That is what is really catalyzing a lot of innovation today, that the barriers to starting new businesses, to the spread of ideas. Remember, this is what Gutenberg really allowed with the first printing press, was the ability of then scientists across borders and across long distances to publish their findings and then share it. And it would take months, sometimes even years, for their ideas to disseminate. Today, those ideas can be disseminated in a matter of hours or days. But you know, let's be clear, Tom. As I point out in the book, I'm not Dr. Pangloss here. I'm not saying everything is wonderful. It clearly is not. But as I point out in the book, the internet is incredibly powerful. But it's also allowed governments to monitor our communications, to track where we are. That, as one guy said, you know, if you're going to have a cell phone, accept that you live in the panopticon, this supposed place where you were under surveillance at every moment. Well, that is, in fact, we are living in some of those kinds of those ideas where some of these brave new world possibilities are, in fact, upon us when it comes to being monitored. But at the same time, all of this the news about us being monitored is also being disseminated. So people are saying, wait, that's not right. We need privacy. And there are limits to what you can do and how you can monitor us. And look at how the Chinese and other repressive governments are trying to limit access to communications and what's happening. People are finding ways around it because they want to connect. They want to be free. They want to share ideas.
Robert, let's jump back to energy policy again.
I'd
like to know what you have to say about what's fashionable these days in energy policy, which is biofuels, so-called green energy, wind power. What's wrong with that? Shouldn't we embrace all possible options when it comes to energy?
No.
Good answer.
Absolutely not. You know, this idea that the president said, oh, I don't know how many thousand times, it's a little for all of the above. No, we're not for all of the above. We're for all of the ones that make sense. Let's agree that the bad ones we need to get rid of and quit supporting the bad ones. Well, what are the bad ones? The bad ones are the ones that are not dense. Density is green. A point that I made in my last book, Power Hungry, a point I make in the new book, density is green. If we're going to be supposedly green, if we're going to protect the environment, we need small footprints. We need to have the minimal amount of incursion into the natural world as we can. It's on its face, it makes sense, right? We don't want sprawl. We want compact cities. We want compact farms. We want compact energy. And what do we have? The reverse of that is what we're seeing with the biofuel scam, particularly the corn ethanol scam, and what we're seeing with the wind energy business. This is, you know, I have a lot of critics from the left. Oh, you know, I don't support wind energy. No, I don't. I think it's a bad idea. Why? Because of energy sprawl, and that is due to basic physics, which is low power density. It's the same problem that afflicts biofuels. Power density of wind energy is 1 watt per square meter. If we wanted to replace coal-fired capacity in the United States with wind energy, we'd need to set aside a land area the size of Italy. We're not going to do it. But yet this steady drumbeat, oh, this is the answer. Same thing with biofuels. We've been scammed. We've been had by the biofuels crowd. The power density of biofuels is measured in fractions of a watt per square meter. You can't get there from here. I don't care what you're putting in your moonshine. It doesn't work.
Why do you think environmentalists emphasize these forms of energy when nuclear power is pretty clean? Is it entirely because they're losing sleep about the safety of nuclear power, do you think? Or in terms of radical environmentalism, what do you think the real agenda is?
Well, let's take the last part of that. First, Tom, the radical environmentalists, and in the book, I take issue with some of these points that have been made by Bill McKibben because I think he fits under that heading of radical environmentalists. McKibben has said that he thinks we need a 20-fold reduction in our hydrocarbon consumption. That's our consumption of coal, oil, and natural gas. Well, in the book, I go through the numbers. Okay, so you want a 20-fold reduction in global hydrocarbon consumption. We're using roughly 215 million barrels of oil equivalent per day. That's in oil, natural gas, and coal combined. A 20-fold reduction would take us down to about 11 million barrels of oil equivalent per day. That's about the total amount of energy that is now consumed by India. And we're going to have the entire planet run on that quantity of coal, oil, and natural gas. Today, we're using over 22 million barrels a day just of gasoline. So the idea that suddenly we're going to have a 20-fold reduction and replace it with what? So we can't live counting on unicorn farts to say this. It's not going to happen. We have to use the forms of energy that we have now and the ones that are proven that are scalable, are low cost, and they are abundant. That's coal, oil, and natural gas. So when you ask what the agenda of some of these environmental groups, I think it's a very radical one. It's a romantic one that we're going to go back and live on the land and we're all going to hold hands and sing kumbaya with Mother Nature. It's just not going to happen.
In your second to last chapter, what are you driving at when you say that the United States will dominate the smaller, faster future? In what way?
You know, this is another area where I part company with some of the talking heads about this idea that America's best days are over, that the U.S. is, China's going to be the dominant player in clean energy or Brazil or, some of these other BRICS. It's not true. when you look at the mega trends that are underway, you look at the advantages that the U.S. has with regard to demographics, with geography, with education, with infrastructure, the U.S. is in an incredibly strong position. And we're going to stay in a very strong position because of those advantages, but more particularly because of cheap, abundant energy. The shale revolution and the fact that the U.S. now has a price advantage when it comes to natural gas and natural gas liquids, butane, ethane, propane, those fuels, as well as oil production, the U.S. is incredibly well positioned when it comes to all of these issues going forward.
Robert, do you have a website or any place where people can find out about you and or the book?
Sure. My main website is robertbrice.com. I post everything I write there. I also have a new site that I put up for the book. It's called smallerfasterlighter.com.
So the book is Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper, How Innovation Keeps Proving the Catastrophists Wrong, out today by Robert Bryce. Robert, thanks so much for your time today. Best of luck with the book. It's a very interesting and enjoyable read, and it is nice to hear some optimism once in a while, especially when it's obviously called for.
Well, I appreciate that, Tom, and I think it is called for, and I'm going to be preaching that message for a long time to come.
Great. Thanks again.
Thanks again.
All right, everybody, make sure and check out Smaller, Faster, Lighter, Denser, Cheaper. You can, of course, get it through Amazon. And, of course, we have a convenient Amazon entry point at tomwoodsradio.com that would really help us out. Just a quick update on a couple of things. I am just about to completely finish my first two courses for the Ron Paul Homeschool curriculum. You can find out about that at ronpaulhomeschool.com. In order to allow more people to take these courses, we opened them up before they were complete. Like, we got 8 weeks ahead of the students, then we opened them up, and then we've added a week's worth of material every week. So I'm just finishing up, well, I've just finished my government course, which you might call an anti-government course, but it's quite thorough and covers an exciting array of topics, so I did that. And I've also done the Western Civ course. I'm just about finished with that. Western Civilization from Antiquity up to about 1492. I'm just about to wrap up those 180 lessons on a variety of topics. So ronpaulhomeschool.com is where you can find out about that. By this fall, we should have pretty much all, just about all of K through 11 ready to go. K through 5 will be available for free, so you'll have 6 years to give the program a test drive. At some point, I will make it possible to get just my courses a la carte without joining the Ron Paul Homeschool program. I'll make an announcement about that, or if you get my newsletter, which you can sign up for at tomwoods.com or tomwoodsradio.com, I'll keep you posted on that. My contractual deal, though, is that you have to get a discount if you go through the Ron Paul Homeschool program as opposed to getting it a la carte from me, because they don't want people to just get everything a la carte. So that's the deal, but you wouldn't have to pay the Ron Paul Homeschool fee, but at the same time, the courses would be pricier. So anyway, deal with that later. Check out ronpaulhomeschool.com today for the reasons to join, because it's a fantastic program. It gives your students a huge leg up in a variety of areas. In a couple of weeks, I'll be starting on my next courses, which will be Western Civilization Part 2 from 1492 to the present, and American Constitutionalism. So that's interesting stuff. It's extremely time-consuming. It's why I don't write very much anymore. But by next year, by, let's say, the spring of next year, those should be all finished as well. You'll be able to sign up for those courses, too, by the fall of this year, 2014, because, again, I'll be making it available before it's done. I'll be ahead of the students by a number of weeks. And so people can start taking it as I'm working on it, and then it'll be done forever. Done forever. I will never have to work on it again. All right, everybody, what else is going on? I'm speaking in Boston on June 2nd. You can get tickets through tomwoods.com/events. You can see the link to get tickets. It's 10 smackers to get in. I'm sorry about that. But if you sign up for your ticket online and then you show up to the event, you get a free subscription to mylibertyclassroom.com. where you can learn the history and economics that they didn't teach you. Get that for free if you order your ticket in advance and then show up. It's going to be at Cheers in Boston, so that'll be a lot of fun. And then June 19th at St. Paul, Minnesota. And then also August 15th already occurred. August 15th, I'm going to be in Nashville, Tennessee with Bob Murphy and a star-studded lineup. I haven't posted that yet. I will soon, so just save the date if you're in the area, August 15th. We'll be talking to Bob Murphy again soon, so maybe we'll have him do a plug for that event. But make sure and get your ticket. I think it sold out last year, so you'll definitely want to get your ticket for that in advance. Those of you who are not coming to see me in Boston can get 50% off libertyclassroom.com using coupon code DISCOUNT in all caps. We're just about to add a couple more courses to the 9 courses that we already have available for download there. All right, everybody, that is the program for today. Thank you so much to my loyal listeners who just keep on listening. Keep on spreading the word about the show. I'm very grateful. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.